I had a very interesting week. This week was very interesting because I had the opportunity to go to a health clinic, a very unique healing center in the south of Florida. It is perhaps the most unique center I have ever seen, especially in America. We were doing an article for a Swedish health magazine, Hälso, and in that article we were supposed to go and interview the people in charge and take photos. And there were people there from all over the world. I was thinking that it was going to be mainly local people, but actually from all over the world, people were coming there. People with very serious diseases, people with cancer, people with other diseases, people who had, in fact, lost hope in life. And they were very encouraged to be there. They renewed their desire to live. They renewed their desire to do something significant for themselves. And this was, for me, very significant to see it practically, to see it in reality. And the thing I would like to talk about in relationship to this is not exactly the healing of it or exactly the methodology or techniques that they used, because you could find these things in other locations if you were to look. Many of these aspects were traditional naturopathy methods, which were coming from Europe, various parts of Europe, Swiss techniques, German techniques, even some which were developed in Sweden, and the raw food and natural food techniques. But what was amazing was that this was all in one place. Everything you could think of, except for the more mystical forms of healing, were all in one place. Now, besides all of this, I think that, basically speaking, the most significant aspect of what it was that I saw there was the transformation of people's lives, the transformation of the mentality of people. What I felt was most significant was that people who came to a life-threatening fork in the road, so to speak, and they were face to face with their own mortality. Now, as you know, in the past, we discussed about the status quo. The status quo is a very interesting concept. It means that people like to remain in the same condition that they are presently in. They don't like to transform. Unless they are forced to, nobody wishes to voluntarily change. Now, if you think about it, if you think about one who is, shall we say, happy in their lives, one who is satisfied with the direction of things, they don't want to change. They don't see any reason to change. They don't see any reason to do anything differently than they are presently doing it. They are feeling that things are all right. So they would resist change because they would feel that change would be something which would transform them away from their good situation. So they would be afraid to allow change to take place for fear of losing that which they consider to be good in their lives. Now, because of that, they would not see a reason to change. They think the status quo is fine. Now, this phenomena is also there for people who are not necessarily totally satisfied with everything, but feel that there is some hope, feel that there is some possibility to come to the point of happiness in the future. People who would feel that if they just continued their going on in their lives, continuing to do whatever they were doing, they would ultimately get to a very good place. So because of their confidence in getting to that good place, they also don't think they should transform radically what they're doing. After all, such transformation means there's going to be a risk. A risk, maybe things aren't going to work out. People would rather stick with something sure than move to something unsure. And if they are going to take a risk, they only do it after investigating it very seriously. And that risk will be within the maintenance of their status quo. That risk would be within the maintenance of their status quo. In other words, it would be something which would support the status quo, but in a better way. Many teachers of self-development, many teachers of parts of personal expansion, like, for example, wealth expansion or others, will speak about this gremlin, it's called, who sits on the shoulder and says, don't change, don't change. And this is the most significant reason for the reduction of beneficial activity or superior forms of action which will really give us what we want in life. And therefore they recommend to be bold, to have courage, to have strength, and to march out into new fields with intelligence, but with confidence that you'll be able to deal with it. In reality, this is a very difficult thing to do, and very few people manage to accomplish it. Because we find security in things which are the same. Situations we can depend on, reactions to what we say which are predictable, income which is predictable and stable. This is the way we are as human beings. We want stability, we want security. I think this is also a function of family life, a function of having to deal with children and having to deal with the economy surrounding family life. We want stability, we want security, because the problem when you don't have it is very great. Who wants to risk the security of the family? Who wants to risk the stability of life when one has children that are depending on one? Nobody does. Therefore, the status quo is important to us as far as our core values go. Core values, those things which we value at the very deepest core of our existence here in this world. So here I am in this clinic, and what is interesting is that here are people whose status quo has been shaken to the very core of their being. At the very core of their being, security is gone, stability is gone. Because in some of these cases, not all, not everybody there was there because they were very, very sick. Some people were there just to get much better. But at the basis of some of these people who I wish to talk about is that their health was gone and their duration of life that they had assumed was there was gone. Now, each of us, in our own amazing way, think that we're going to live for a very long time. In our maintenance of our status quo, part of our security and stability is our very long duration of life. We're going to live a long time, and we're going to make a lot of money to support everything, and we're going to be there to help them when they need us, and so on. After all, the most significant part of the status quo is the duration of our life. Because without it, there's no status quo at all. Now, just consider this. All of a sudden, that is taken away by a diagnosis by a doctor. You have this disease. This disease is life-limiting in some way or another. Perhaps it is limiting your capacity to walk. Perhaps it is limiting your capacity to live. Perhaps it is limiting your capacity even to maintain a clear consciousness. So in some way or another, this news is impacting very seriously and transforming the whole way in which one has thought about life. One day one thought, things are okay, they're going to just get better if I work really hard. The next day one thinks, what is my future? Now consider any person who is shown the temporality of a significant life, either where their duration of life is challenged or the quality of life is significantly challenged. Actually, they are in a fork in the road. In this fork in the road, they can move in one of two directions. They can either surrender to the inevitable, in other words, the inevitable downfall, or they can make a significant change. Now, many people might think, and I know all of us have thought this way at one point in time, or maybe multiple points in time, that it's easy to just roll down the hill. I know in my life, there have been many occasions where I'm faced with something very significant, a challenge very significant, and sometimes I think, well, if I just let it go, if I just play the ostrich with the head in the sand, it'll just go away. If I just avoid the situation, it will somehow mysteriously vanish into the air. I have felt like that often in my life, and I'm sure everybody has. It's a natural human response that we feel when situations are very difficult for us. And any of us who have felt challenged at some time in our life know this situation well. We know the thought process we go through as we surrender to what we call the inevitable. Now, sometimes that is a good technique. That is also an Eastern technique of just let it be, just accept, don't be disturbed, be totally detached from life. Sometimes, in very specific kinds of circumstances, that might work. When you're living a detached life, when you don't have to deal with any support systems or possessions, when you're not living within a society, it's acceptable to have that mentality. But as even Chanakya Panda said, three things you have to deal with: fire, debt, and disease. Because if you don't deal with any one of these, they consume you. In situations where letting things go is a bad idea, and you have done so, you know the pain of the fall. And the pain of the fall can be extremely damaging. Just like as you may think it's easy to fall down a hill. After all, you don't have to do any work. But as you are bouncing and hitting rocks and smashing and cracking, you realize how much it hurts. So surrendering to the fall is not necessarily easier than fighting the fall. In fact, most of the time, if not all of the time, I can't say, you can't make any generalization about this, but most of the time, working against this falling where you lose all control is superior than letting it go. Because it can be very, very, very harmful. It can be very painful to just let things go. So what I saw is that these people who had been given this diagnosis, who had been given this clarity about the instability of their situation, were very unique. Because they did not choose to let it go. They did not choose to surrender to the inevitable. They chose to transform. They chose to do something very valuable with their life, to preserve the value of their lives. Now, most of you there in Russia, you know about Jasmuheen. We've brought her over a few times. And you know about her methodology of living on light. But she didn't always do that. She used to be a regular person, just like you and me. But one day, she got one of those diagnoses, which completely challenged the stability of her life. You have cancer, you have 6 months to live. Now, just think about hearing those words. Whatever you may have thought about your life, whatever plans you may have had, whatever ideas you have about the status quo, cut to pieces. All hope for the future washed away. Now, she didn't accept to fall down the hill. And very good for us, too, because by not accepting that, she created a means which millions of people can find a transformation in their lives. She said, no, I'm going to choose to take control of this situation. I'm going to choose to do something significant to transform the situation that I'm in. So she started fasting. She started doing very deep meditation. She started calling down energies of light, calling down angelic energies to help her. So she not only cured herself, but she so changed her life that she is what she is today. This whole movement based on living foods came from one Swedish lady who had such serious arthritis and rheumatism that she could not move anymore. She couldn't even move. She was so paralyzed by her rheumatism and arthritis, she woke up one morning and could not open her mouth. And we're talking many years ago, long time ago. And all she could do was just sip soaked potato water or other raw vegetable water through a straw. Juices, that's all she could do. And by living on this raw diet, she cured herself from this such serious condition where others may have said, let me roll down the hill. She said, no, I'll try something. And she transformed into the founder of this raw foods movement. So when you're faced with a situation you cannot control, when you're faced with a situation which is much bigger than what you are, it demands heroism. And within that heroism, things can develop which are extraordinary. By the way, if you look at wars throughout the world, throughout time, the greatest technological advances, especially within the last 200 years, have come at times of war. To develop new weapons to kill the enemy, to develop things to protect the soldiers, to develop medical techniques to take care of them, to develop transportation methods, communication methods to make the war work better. And around these serious situations which are out of control in war, all this modernity, the modernization of society has been very much advanced. So we see when there's times of crisis, when the situation's out of control, advancement seems to follow. And I would like to say that this whole concept of status quo becomes challenged usually when there is no other choice. When you're not going to be able to succeed at continuing things the way they are, you have to either make a choice to change or simply let it kill you. And people who decide to change often change in such a way that not only do they conquer that situation which forced them to change in the first place, but they become so much greater because of it. One wonders why we don't change voluntarily. Well, because we are just people who don't like to change radically. And it's amazing how change comes from above often. It comes in divine ways. It comes in ways we would have never imagined. It's almost as if the universe is seeing us stuck in our lives and pushes upon us a situation gently or perhaps suddenly that forces us to see everything differently, that forces us to see our life from a totally different point of view and forces us to accept a transformation in life which is so significant It is for our greatest benefit. If you look at, even in the Bhagavad Gita, when Krishna speaks about four types of people who are eager to surrender to him, one of them are those who are suffering so much that they really need to do something to transform it. Very few are those who seek out this kind of a path simply for expansion of knowledge, expansion of consciousness. You will find that there's always some kind of suffering involved, some kind of lousy situation that one wants to overcome. I remember in Germany we used to laugh that nobody would come to ISKCON unless they had tried to commit suicide and had failed. So that made you the perfect candidate to take up spiritual life. My God, why are we so stubborn that for us to do something to expand our consciousness, to develop ourselves, we have to practically be at the door of death? Human beings are very mysterious. It's actually fabulous the way in which the illusions of the world to remain in the status quo and to develop it as it is are so powerful. It depends on your value. Also, we visited in South Florida some Indian family. That was also interesting because we had a conversation, which I'd like to share one part of it with you. And we were discussing the differences between America and India, which is transforming radically. And I was speaking about my experiences with Indians, with even very successful Indians, and my experience with Americans. Actually, it's starting to become like this in other parts of the world, too. The American model of that I'm going to explain. In America, everything is based on money. First money, then everything else. That money has become so incredibly significant, it rules the fundamental aspects of everybody's life. Even when we were in that healing center, those people who had to deal with the economic aspects of that center were completely stressed. Those people who were dealing with the healing aspects of it were peaceful and calm and happier. And those people who were worrying about how to make ends meet, they just couldn't capture the same mood as the people who were caring about others to heal. That didn't make them bad people. They were all very good people. But the reality, or the reality that has been created of economic requirement, forced the stress from the outside world to come in and infect them. After all, there are bills to be paid, people to be paid, facilities to maintain. Everything had to work. So there was a stress in that. And we find this whole place here is filled with people worrying about making ends meet. Money is number one. Everything else is following. Of course, there are people who don't think like that. This is just a generalization about this country. Now, in India, very interesting, is that even amongst the richest people, money is secondary. Money is, even in the Varnashram ideal, the third thing down. Even today, you will find people basically have a stability in their lives, that family, their health, their stability as people is more important than the money. Obviously, there are exceptions. There's no way that everybody is the same in any place. But the general mood still is a mood where money is not as important as the life itself. Of course, amongst politicians, you see everything is quite different for those. Politicians have a very difficult time being human beings, it seems, nowadays. But wherever money is involved, wherever power is involved, control is involved like this, there is incredible stress. And this stress is eating away at the stability of life. And it is for this reason that people don't look for expanding their consciousness, don't reach out for the spirituality in life. It's just not practical when you live in a society of money-making ideals. Now, I feel personally that the universe is so kind upon us that when we need it the most, things are arranged to force our transformation. And I've seen this in my life again and again. Even when I'm doing things which I shouldn't be, forced to make a change. When I'm living a lifestyle I shouldn't be, forced to make a change. If there's something in my life which needs to be transformed, the universe so kindly makes that transformation. And again, I'm forced to reassess my situation. I'm forced to consider again, what am I doing? Am I doing the right thing? Should I make a transformation? What can I do to deal with this situation? And usually, the decision I make is leading me in a direction which is helpful. Because when I'm forced up against the wall, even I, believe it or not, even me can see the value of changing the status quo. Sometimes I look in the mirror and I say, oh my God, I've got to change. And I go, oh, horror! I like status quo. It's my friend. I like to be able to know what is and how things can be maintained and so on. I like that. It's dependable. Just like anyone else, I don't like to go into the unknown. I don't like to go into a completely dark room. When I was younger, oh, so long ago, it was a little bit different. I used to go out of my way to just change everything without any consideration. To reach out for that new experience, to reach out into the unknown, to explore, to discover. Then something happened. I'm not sure what, but I changed. I think it had to do with growing older. I felt that things are better off not changing. Things are better off not so radical. I don't know why. I don't know why I made that transformation. So I settled in to a very secure situation. And the universe looked down on me and said, what is this idiot thinking? Okay, this is not going to continue. So here is this situation. Deal with it. And change is forced. Now what will you do with it? And I put the same question to all of you who either have been or will be at some time when you most need it in a similar situation. Are you happy with the way everything is? Do you think that if you just keep doing what you do better, you're going to get to that stability, you're going to get to that security? And therefore, whatever you're doing now is just fine? Do you think like that? Do you have a little green gremlin on your shoulder here who sits there and says, everything's okay, don't change? And then you think, maybe I should do this. And the gremlin says, no, no. These gremlins, they are very powerful because we think that they represent our mind or our consciousness or whatever, that they are part of us and that they're helping us. So we have to consider, is that really so? Is the maintenance of the status quo really working to our benefit? Or should we be bold? Should we have courage? I can't answer that question for you. I can't even answer that question for me sometimes, because sometimes the future is very frightening. The more intelligent you are, the more difficult it is to deal with the situation. Because intelligent people can see all of the different ways in which everything can go completely to hell. If I make this change, oh, that might happen. Or that might happen. Oh my God, one doesn't want to change. Okay, maybe this good thing will happen, but maybe not. Maybe that, oh, what, this, that, the other thing. So many problems, a little bit of chance of success. Oh, what shall I do? Sometimes I think being too intelligent is a curse because you can always see all the way things go wrong. Don't forget, ignorance is bliss. Now, I'm not exactly sure how ignorance is bliss, but it just is a fun thing to say. Now, for sure, intelligent people need courage. Intelligent people need strength more than anyone else because when they take a risk, they know how it can go bad. The ignorant don't know how it can go bad. Therefore, for them, making the decision is not so significant as it is for one who actually knows all of the things that can go wrong. Therefore, fearlessness, courage, bravery, and the capacity to innovate are very important for human beings. But it's not always easy to do that. It's often very, very difficult. And so therefore, what I'm saying is when you are faced with a situation you cannot deal with in the usual way, like a diagnosis, you've got 6 months to live, or you're deteriorating rapidly, or you may never walk again, you're forced to deal with it. And just because there were success stories of people who did deal with it doesn't mean it will work in your case. There's no guarantee. There's no guarantee that if you are bold, you are courageous, and you do make a total change, you're going to have that kind of success. There were people there who I took one look at and knew they're not going to live very long. They had made all the changes. They had made all the decisions. They did everything right. It just wasn't going to be. But was the transformation a waste of time? No, because they die better. They have died in an evolved condition. The physical body will not maintain, but they will move in an evolved way into the next life. Not at all a loss. Not at all a failure. They dealt with it. They accepted the challenge. And they got the benefit, except that it was manifested in the future. Yet many people made such a life transformation that they have developed the capacity to renew their stability, renew their flourishing, prosperous lives. The only guarantee there is in this fork in the road, these two choices you can make, is that if you take the choice to fall down, you absolutely will, and it will be painful. Whereas those who take the choice to do something about it, they may not get physical guarantees, but they will certainly conquer that which they needed to conquer in this life. This reminds us of, again, another Bhagavad Gita saying that you are not guaranteed the fruits of the results of your work, but you have a right to do it. You have a right to work to beat this situation. You don't have a right to actually victory, to actually attaining victory. But then again, it depends on how you define victory. If you define victory as conquering disease, you may not get it. But if you define victory as having met the challenge with spirit and growing in power, growing in awareness, growing your consciousness, you have been victorious, even if your body dies. That's kind of like the Kshatriya who goes into battle knowing there's a big possibility of death or serious injury, but still fights on because it's the victory itself is the fighting of the good battle. So I saw in these people, I saw the warriors who were fighting the battle. They were strong. They were proclaiming their right to conquer whatever it was that they were dealing with. They were all speaking about being empowered, how this program made them empowered to take back control of their lives. And that gave them the strength to do what they had to do to attain their own personal victory. This is kind of what we are doing here in our Harry Media program. We have a program. It's the Harry Media program. And what are we doing? Trying to empower ourselves to take back control of our lives. Our Harry Media program is meant to give us the strength, to give us the clarity by which we can take this impossible situation we are in, the spirit bound here within this universal network, and to turn it into an opportunity to manifest our being, to see the entanglement of spirit within the physiological existence as an opportunity rather than a problem, to see how our love and our desire to be of service can manifest in a causeless manner, even though all that which is around us is demanding payment. Think about it. Think about how everywhere you turn, you are expected to pay. And think about how, if in your own life, you are causelessly offering of yourself, without that, think about how you are contradicting the entire flow of humanity. And feel secure within yourself that you have such a strength, you have such love, you have such desire. For in reality, this is very empowering. You don't need anything to be that loving, beautiful person you are. For you already are what you are, that loving, beautiful person. What you do need to understand is that all this which says you're not that is not true. That in reality, you have the capacity not only to transform yourself, but to significantly impact the lives of others. And you become a generator of healing. You become a cynosure of all that is good. And instead of having to be forced to transform, you reach out for it eagerly. You reach out for that evolution. You reach out for that transformation. You reach out for that growth of your power and energy and love. We have that power. We have that capacity. We are already very powerful beings. But often you don't know your power unless you've got to demonstrate it against some force. You don't know how many muscles you have until you have to start lifting those weights. And you don't know how much love you have, how much capacity to be of service you have, until you start to send it out into a world which is simply demanding your attention, your payment, and your servitude to it. To be what you are, to be that loving, beautiful person you are in the face of such adversity demonstrates your glory. And I congratulate all of you in your fabulous capacity for doing so. And I congratulate those of you who are now figuring out how to make such a transformation. This person is asking me, if we have the power to evolve, then why did Advaitacharya call upon God to help all of the suffering people? I don't really understand the fundamental reason for asking this question, because the answer is so obvious. Just because I can evolve in my own way doesn't mean that I don't ask for help from God or the Supreme or the divine energy. It's absurd to think I stand alone. I don't stand alone in this world. I'm standing with the help of all of the divine beings. And if I really want to help others, the first thing I will do will be to ask the divine beings or angelic beings or go directly to God, please help these people. All healing depends on that. All mercy for others who otherwise would not even know how to begin to get it depends on that. Now, just because one asks for help or asks for help for others doesn't mean that one doesn't have the responsibility to take that help and use it to better one's life. And from that point of view, naturally, you would ask for help for others. It's perfectly natural. In other words, you're asking, please give that help, give that energy, give that strength so that these people may evolve. Or put another way, please give them the stimulus or the situation within which they will best find their benefit. So from that point of view, I think the answer is very obvious. Okay, but from another point of view, when I in the beginning questioned the motivation for asking this question, I sensed that there is some feeling that either you get it all from God or you do it all yourself. I'm hearing this old dichotomy that everything comes as the mercy of God or everything comes by our own work to attain God. And although I understand the motivation that people have when they say that we are totally dependent on God, I understand the motivation that other people have that say, no, it depends on our work. But the combination of these two is not an unusual thing. After all, it's common sense. I'm born in this life. My parents help me to grow where I do things. I go to school. My teachers teach me to do things, and I do them. So it's a combination of superior help and my own acceptance of the help to manifest action or knowledge. And therefore, this feeling that it must be one or the other is a very human construction. It's something where we like to make everything black or white. The real world is not black or white. The real world is in vivid color. This person's saying that, well, I have a very strange gremlin sitting on my shoulder. From time to time, this gremlin says, hey, for a long time you didn't change anything. You better change something. Well, that's not the gremlin that I was talking about. That's the youth. That's the enthusiasm. That's the feeling of life that wants to experience in very unique ways. And yet it's you growing older and having less enthusiastic energy to do that. And so it's the youth within you saying, wait a minute, not changing anything? This means you're getting older. Whoa, that's no good. Better do something. Usually this happens really strongly around the age of 40. It's called the midlife crisis, where you realize, wait a minute, I'm stuck here in this. I've got to change something drastically. I mean, I'm getting old and I just feel it. I have to do something to renew my youth. Anyway, it's not the same gremlin we've been talking about. That's something else. Here's another question. This person is trying to figure out the main essence, or the most essential quality that links all beings and people. They are trying to figure out what would be the basic platform upon which all religionists can meet. And then at the end of this question, our inquirer says, I think maybe I could be a utopian who thinks that there is such a possibility where everybody can live peacefully. Now this question enters into various topics. And although it's such a big topic, it could be practically the subject matter of a book, I'll try to make this answer brief. Now, if you think about it, there are people who are religionists and people who are spiritualists. Now, there are other people who are in neither of those groups, but I'm going to talk about the difference between a religionist and a spiritualist. Now, if you think about people who are religionists, and you think about them having these conflicts, you will understand it has a lot to do with their religion. Spiritualists have very little to fight over. Religionists have a lot to fight over. I'm a spiritual energy. I'm living my life to be the best I can. I'm trying to be of service, or I'm trying to manifest my love. How do you fight over these things? Not possible. But you can certainly fight over, my God is the best God, and your God is not the best God. My God is the real God, your God is the false God. And when it comes to a battle between my God and your God, my God wins, your God loses. Now, if you think about that, this concept that there's a better and worse kind of God, and that unless you understand God in the right way, you can't be successful, you'll understand where some people go so far as to say that it's either my way or you should be dead. So from that point of view, it's almost impossible that you will come up with some utopian kind of platform upon which religionists will feel that peace amongst each other. Because the very fact that you are a religionist in that way means you're buying into some belief system which is different than somebody else's belief system. And even though everybody may believe in spirit, everybody may believe in love, everybody may believe in service, but when you buy into the idea that your God is the real God, or your prophet is the real prophet, or your understanding is the real understanding, you immediately have made separation between you and anyone else who's not in your group. And don't forget that people who have such an idea always want to preach it to others, always want to make sure others follow what they are doing because it helps them believe in it more. So peace is very difficult. Therefore, usually what spiritualists conceive of is where they just do whatever they can do and they feel no reason to fight with anyone else who's doing what he can do best. I think this idea of accommodation comes from seeing oneness in diversity, or even more, diversity in the oneness. When you see that diversity in the oneness, you'll be able to understand that all of this is part of the arrangement of the Supreme. And in that way you can respect and accept it. So I hope that answered that question.